Okay, the Lord be with you.
And
Also
also
with
with
you.
you.
Also with
Also
you.
with
Let's
you.
pray. Good and gracious God, we give you thanks. We give you thanks for the opportunity together today on this Wednesday afternoon. We give you thanks for the opportunity to learn and grow. We ask that you come among us now. May our eyes be open, our hearts be open, our souls, our spirits be enriched by this time together as we engage once more the Acts of the Apostles. All this we pray in Jesus' name, amen.
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 All right, so a couple of notes here. We have been, well, we're going to pick things up in Acts chapter 17, chapter 17, verse 1. And I'm not going to recap, but I will say, I thought I was maybe one YouTube video behind before I left on vacation. I realized I was three behind. So if you've tried to follow along and have had not any luck getting onto those, I hope you were able to catch up or access those before I left. But hey, Stephanie, good to see you too. We're gonna pick things up here. Acts chapter 17, verse 1. I'll try to be better about getting those things back up onto YouTube in a timely manner again. We are, well, let's, you know what? Let's just, well, I will say one more thing. What I'm going to say is, you may have noticed, and I think I might have said this the last time we were together, or the week before, but really, we're at that point of the book of Acts now, where most of the action is going to center on Paul, right? So until about chapter 15, I mean, at the very beginning of the story, it was Peter and the apostles, and then sending, and Paul kind of wove in and out a little bit, and more a lot of Peter stories, and some of Paul. We really are at that point now where we get it sort of becomes the life and times of the Apostle Paul, well, more like the adventures of the Apostle Paul. I'm just going to recommend a couple of things for folks who really want to dial into Paul's life. If you find yourself curious at the end of the study, N.T. Wright's bestseller, Paul, it's kind of a thick book, but N.T. Wright is a former bishop of the Episcopalian diocese in Durham, North Carolina. Well, world-renowned scholar of New Testament studies, Pauline studies, and I recommend this book. It's a great book. We're not going to read it together, but if you want to dig into Paul, if you're inspired, there's that. There's also, if you feel yourself academically curious, there's a fairly accessible online course put together by Harvard Divinity School that is free and open. I'll send out the link at some point. It's through what's called Harvard X. It's a course that they put together for church groups and things. I think it's a little more academic than we normally, I mean, y'all can always engage those. There's just a lot more reading, a lot of secondary sources and academic literature, but it is a phenomenal course. And I've gone through it in the past. So lots to go on for the life and times of the Apostle Paul. So we'll just say that, and just know, if you're looking through this thinking, gosh, are we ever going to get back to Peter? Are we ever going to hear about those other folks? Pretty much the answer is no. I mean, I might be wrong about that, but really, we are riding with Paul from here on out. So let's begin chapter 17, verse 1. Who would like to read chapter 17, 1 through 9? Bruce, I see your hand. Go ahead.
Ready to go.
Give it a go.
Okay. After Paul and Silas had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. And Paul went in, as was his custom, and on three Sabbath days argued with them from the scriptures, explaining and proving that it was necessary for the Messiah to suffer and to rise from the dead, and saying, "This is the Messiah, Jesus, whom I am proclaiming to you." Some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a great many of the devout Greeks, and not a few of the leading women. But the Jews became jealous, and with the help of some ruffians in the marketplaces, they formed a mob and set the city in an uproar. While they were searching for Paul and Silas to bring them out to the assembly, they attacked Jason's house. When they could not find them, they dragged Jason and some believers before the city authorities, shouting, "These people who have been turning the world upside down have come here also, and Jason has entertained them as guests. They are all acting contrary to the decrees of the emperor, saying that there is another king named Jesus." The people and the city officials were disturbed when they heard this, and after they had taken bail from Jason and the others, they let them go.
Okay. Thanks, Bruce. So words, images, phrases, what stands out to you? What do you notice? What tugs at you in this? Yeah, Dixie, lead us away.
You know what I'm thinking about as he's reading this is Pastor Darren's sermon on Sunday. There's politics in the Bible all over the place. You just can't get away from it.
Yeah, we can't get away from it. Yeah, that's right. And how did that strike you, Dixie? I remember Pastor Darren led with, "For those of you who, like me, are kind of, you know, uncomfortable in your seats right now, hear and may say those things, we have a discomfort, right?" And I wonder, Dixie, give us some color to that. What do you think?
Well, I just think in so much of history, not really much has changed. You know, with people's feelings and the politics and the arguments, you know, it's been going on for centuries and centuries. And it's probably a good thing that there's some discussion and some opposing views and different ideas. And I think maybe it's all good.
Yeah, I was reminded at the Bible study this morning. So remember, the book of Acts is written by Luke, and we studied Luke in this previous year together. And I was reminded of this in my study with my colleagues this morning on our gospel. But the gospel of Luke begins, you remember those famous words, "In the days of Emperor Augustus, a decree went out that all should be registered," right? That's the birth story of Jesus. The gospel also begins with a word about the political landscape happening in Rome and how that impacts Jerusalem. That's all politics, right? And what's fascinating is that Caesar Augustus, the one who sets the Roman Empire in motion to become an empire at the hands of an emperor, Caesar Augustus, upon his death, was voted by the Senate, because that's the Roman theology. The Senate can vote to do this. He was voted that he became a god, basically. So there was a cult, a worshiping site, a worshiping group, people who worshiped Caesar Augustus, Julius Caesar. So that Caesar Augustus, that's the second Roman emperor, adopted son of Julius Caesar. Oftentimes in life, Caesar Augustus bore the title of Caesar Augustus, son of God, right? Caesar Augustus is son of Julius Caesar, which means he's the son of a God, which actually in Greek and Latin is ambiguous. So you can say son of God, son of a God. It says the same thing. So this whole story of Luke, the Gospel of Luke, and now into Acts, one commentator says it all begins with the story of two sons of God, right? One is the emperor, son of God, son of a god, or a person claiming that he is son of a god. That's the key. And then Jesus, the true son of God. There it is, right, Dixie? That politics and religion side by side, intermingling from the get-go. These things are on a collision course from the very outset of the story. And Luke has taken us through that over and over again. So thanks, Dixie. I'm glad you brought us there right away. Yeah, others. Yeah, Bruce, go ahead.
I appreciate that because I've been really thinking a lot lately about what we were reading in church several times, and it was love your enemies. Remember? And that's hard to do. And I've been kind of focused on that about, you know, what's my true feeling do I love my enemies and what's how am I succeeding at that, you know, or not succeeding? Some of this is pretty obvious, you know, people being thrown in jail or worse, but just how people behave to each other.
Yeah, you know, Bruce, I hope I'm not speaking too much out of turn, but you know, you and Cheryl have asked me. I've preached about Christian nationalism in the United States, and Bruce and Cheryl said, "Hey, we don't really know that term, and can you give us some more information on that?" And so I dug up some a Lutheran resource. What do we mean by this term? Why are Lutherans nervous about this? You know, put some flesh on the bones here. One of the reasons that I am nervous about what I call white Christian nationalism is that for a force in American politics claiming a rooted identity in Jesus, I don't hear love of neighbor. And I certainly don't hear love of enemy. And it's hard for me, the Reverend Bishop William Barber. I went to a conference and he says, I don't call it white Christian nationalism. I call it pseudo-Christian nationalism because they ain't acting like Jesus. And he's got a good point. Well, okay, that's words at this point. But it's a, you know, Bruce, I think that's really important. This belonging to Jesus, the one who told us not to just love our neighbor or our friends, but our enemy, right? That's a, whew, that turns the world in a way. Go ahead, Scott.
I mean, I understand love thine enemy, which is typically unrequited, but is it okay to love thine enemy but not like them?
I think so. Yeah, absolutely. I'm seeing Sherry's going, yes.
Yep.
Yeah, I think, I mean, what's your intuition and what's behind the question, Scott? I've already given away the answer for me, but I want to hear more from you.
Well, it's this whole hatred business. So many people espouse hatred for other. And I'm always ready to jump on that bandwagon. But I'm trying to be better, trying to quit. But it's really hard to, I guess I'm saying converting hating into dislike. So I'm just spitballing here.
Yeah. It's a I think it's a real challenge of the journey of faith, right? Is how do we take the teachings and the life of Jesus and practice that? And for me, it very much has to be a practice, right? I like to actually talk about practicing ministry, like, you know, doctors and lawyers practice their skill because I don't think you ever arrive at ministry as a profession. I think you're always working on it. And I think that that's the experience of faith too, is it's not a destination we get to. It's the journey. It's the practice of. It's the wrestling. And sometimes when we're doing that, we take 10 steps back, or we revert into old habits. We do dumb things. We speak out of turn. We let our anger, wash over us. Which is really important that we have the font at the back of the room, and that's really important that we take communion every Sunday. We have a place to come home to, right? Those are what those things are. It's like, oh yeah, I did that thing where I called my enemy a jerk again and hated them for a while. Oh, come home, come home, come home. Yeah, that's yeah. I appreciate you raising that up, Scott. Go ahead, Stephanie.
Verse 4 surprised me, where it says that a great many of the devout Greeks and not a few of the leading women. That surprised me to see that.
Yeah, what do you make of that, Stephanie?
Well, it always seemed to me that women were kind of pushed into the background in a lot, most of Bible stories. And the fact that they're talking about the leadership in the church, and they're recognizing, Luke is recognizing that there were women in leadership.
We've it's sprinkled, right? It's they're sprinkled. We had Dorcas, Lydia. We've seen some women come in and out. If you were with us way, 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 way back at the beginning of the Luke Bible study, there are some scholars who have a thesis or a theory that the writer of the Gospel of Luke may even indeed be a woman, because nowhere in the gospel writings is attention given to women so frequently, right? It's not just, oh, they were here and then they're gone. They're secondary characters. Oh, here they're gone. It's like with this repetition, we see the impact of female disciples and female apostles on the mission of Jesus, on the mission of the Spirit. And some scholars say, that's almost that is so radical for an ancient text to do that. Some scholars say, that's all the evidence I need to think that the author of Luke and Acts is a woman. At that point, I think we're kind of on speculation, but it's kind of a beautiful thesis, I think. And it's a helpful reminder that Luke really is an important, or Acts here is really an important voice against that patriarchal nonsense that the church has sometimes fallen into, right? This male-dominated hierarchy that we're just really trying to shake. So here we go, Stephanie. I'm glad you picked up on that. Hey, Sandy, good to see you. We're in chapter 17, verses 1 through 8.
Thank you.
I also want to put your attention to something before we move on. Notice, notice in verse 6, going into, well, at the end of verse 6, the accusation. These people who have been turning the world upside down have come here also. Jason has entertained them as guests. So Jason is a Greek host for them. His crime is hospitality, which is, man, interesting. That's seditious, they're saying. What's interesting here is this euphemism, these people turning the world upside down. That's a really, really serious charge in Roman law, apparently. However, there's something kind of interesting about that. One of the ways that Hebrew, or one of the ways that rabbis, whether you're talking about Jesus or the Old Testament idea of Messiah, one of the things that Messiah does, one of the ways of understanding who Messiah is or what to expect, is the one Who turns the world upside down? That's one of the phrases. That's one of the phrases that rabbis use or have used to teach about Messiah. And but they'll often say the one who turns the world right side up, actually. But it's the same movement. The structure as it is going to be turned on its head. So, but kind of back to Dixie's initial, bringing us right to this relationship of religion and politics. These ideas are closely linked, right? These ideas, they've got footing, so it's kind of funny that they say these people turning the world upside down talking about Jesus, and the disciples are sitting there going, yeah, we are turning the world upside down. You're right. That's what we do. That's what Jesus does. Yep. So they're guilty as charged, but not in the seditious way I think that they're being truly accused of here. Well, let's move on. Let's just finish this out. Do I have a reader for 10 through 15? Somebody 10 through 15, a short passage here. All right, Dixie, I said a short passage. I saw your hand go right up. Go ahead.
Right up. As soon as it was night, the believers sent Paul and Silas away to Berea. On arriving there, they went to the Jewish synagogue. Now the Berean Jews, I'm sorry, what? Oh. Now the Berean Jews were of more noble character than those in Thessalonica, for they received the message with great eagerness and examined the scriptures every day to see if what Paul said was true. As a result, many of them believed, as did also a number of prominent Greek women and many Greek men. But when the Jews in Thessalonica learned that Paul was preaching the word of God at Berea, some of them went there too, agitating the crowds and stirring them up. The believers immediately sent Paul to the coast, but Silas and Timothy stayed at Berea. Those who escorted Paul brought him to Athens and then left with instructions for Silas and Timothy to join him as soon as possible.
Thanks, Dixie. All right, so kind of another, transition. I've called this a little passage of transition here. But before we move on, what do you see? Words, images, phrases. Anybody want to pull anything out of this? Go ahead, Sue.
Okay, it's not as if this, but I keep picturing protesters in our day and age.
Say more about
Those
that.
that
What do
are,
you mean?
okay, those that are bringing things to light that need to be brought to light or whatever, but I'm picturing those that they're talking about, I would equate to today's protesters.
Are you talking about Paul and Silas are protesters or the ones who are against
The
them?
crowd, the crowds.
The crowds. Interesting. That's it. I mean, we've certainly got crowds of people opposing something that's happening publicly, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's an old tradition. Go ahead, Sherry.
Well, I'm noticing that Paul is being scooted off out of trouble, and then over here now he's scooted off more trouble. So, yeah, Paul was important and also in trouble. Yeah.
So it's not Paul as it's not quite Paul as celebrity, right? But we do get a flavor of it's kind of a mix of Billy the Kid meets Taylor Swift, right? I'm glad that got a chuckle I saw. There's a touch here, like, but I think this is really the point. Faith and the work of the Spirit, one scholar or one theologian says, is a happening, right? And so just as we talk about, like, I don't know, it used to be probably something in the 70s, people would say, oh, that's a happening place, right? Oh, go to that bar, go to that place, it's a happening place. That's exactly how I mean that. That when you're caught up in the work of the Spirit, things happen. It's a happening place. And Sherry, that's kind of what I hear in this, right? Paul all of a sudden is becoming sort of the center of the apostles' orbit, right? And really, that's what the Spirit does. It becomes a happening, right? The human life begins to be caught up, motivated, inspired by that. Yeah, go ahead, Sandy.
Was Berea the place where the Bereans searched the scriptures day and night? It's I don't remember where it was, but they were a group of people who really looked into the scriptures and were very interested in knowing as much as they could.
That's interesting.
Somebody, I've heard somebody say, be like the Bereans. They search scripture day and night.
Oh, interesting. You know what? I'm not familiar with that. I just checked one of my Bibles with a really good set of notes on the bottom, and I don't see that, but I've never heard that phrase. Interesting. Well, there's your homework, Sandy. You got to go dig that up for us.
Okay.
That's fascinating. Well, let's so here we Paul's really about to hit the big time here. This next passage has really tickled, I think, those of us who let's see, Europeans, Westerners, because in some ways this is Paul meeting Western civilization. He's already met it before, but we're about to see Paul in Athens, which is kind of a big deal for us. I'm wondering if we have a bold reader who would take this in one chunk. If not, we could split it up. But verses 16 through 34, carry us through the rest of this this chapter 17. So 16 through 34, who'd be willing to do that? Sandy. Okay. Oh, I got Sandy before I got you, Bruce. So she's on the hook. Take us away.
So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you're very religious."
Hold on, Sandy. Start at verse 16.
16. Okay, sorry.
Now, that's all right.
While Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him, and some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities, because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection." And they took him and brought him to Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting? For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean." Now, all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you: the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. Being God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold, silver, or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed, and of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. Now, when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, but others said, "We'll hear you again about this." So Paul went out from their midst. But some men joined him and believed, among whom also were Dionysius, an Areopagite, and a woman named Damaris, and others with them.
Nicely done. Thank you, Sandy. Some tricky words in there. So thanks for just, you read that with such confidence. I think that was beautiful. Nice work. So words and images, phrases, here we have a sermon. What do we see? What do we see in this text? Go ahead, Sherry.
I have a question. Verse 30, the times of ignorance. Is that prior to Jesus being in the world?
It's interesting. What I took that's an interesting question for the Greek. In Greek, there are actually two words. Here's your nerdy Greek fact of the day. There are two words for time. One is chronos. Chronos is like a clock, right? Succinct minutes and seconds. And then another is kairos. And kairos is ages, eons, eras. So kairos and chronos. And they both translate into this word time. I'm going to guess this is chronos, but let me just see because it'll inform the way I respond here. So verse 30. Chronos. Interesting. Interesting. Okay. So this is the times of ignorance. So this means this is the specific times where we as human beings, so Paul could be speaking kind of differently here. He could mean the times when we've erred in our own judgment, where we made the wrong decision or we were ignorant. He could also mean the times when a people, like say the Athenians, their time of ignorance, their chronos of ignorance would be, they just haven't heard about Jesus, right? So they were ignorant. That was a succinct moment of time. Now that time is over because he, Paul, has come with the gospel. That time is done. So he does mean like a succinct moment in time. I don't know if that helps, but yeah. Sherry, what does that do for you? Yeah.
Well,
what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, if I think back on all the people that didn't have the word, the native people, the people back in so far history that didn't know what God was, or maybe they knew some being was bigger and they worshiped that, whatever it was, the sun or the moon or whatever, the water. But so I just was curious about the times of ignorance, and that probably would be, I mean, I see us now, we could say, yes, I've been ignorant, but now I see the light, now I've heard the word, and so now I understand. So I just was curious,
yeah.
This is an old Bible and old writing and time of ignorance, I was curious.
You know, and it's also interesting, I mean, we talk about this sometimes on Tuesday morning. I think Gene and Dusty brought this up yesterday. What do we do with people who seem to be living really wonderful lives, who don't identify as Christian, right? And certainly emanating goodness and love and mercy, and boy, they even act like Jesus. The sense that I get from this text as we're looking toward those, I mean, we'd call that ignorance or not. What I see here, Paul is being incredibly generous, right? Paul is, just remember, let's remember Paul. Paul used to be the strictest, most observant Jew you ever knew, right? He is so observant that he used to do for a profession this ugly thing of hounding non-believers, even with violence. Here, he is standing in the most Gentile place in the world. Like the Areopagus is the center of philosophy going back 1,000 years. It's the center of the Gentile imagination. And he's not flinching as if he needs to take a bath afterwards, right? He's entering in with curiosity and generosity and love into that which is so foreign and so unclean. And he's doing so with a graciousness. And he's also saying, hey, God is gracious here too. That's I think, part of the thrust of this also, is he's really not coming with fire and brimstone. You hellions, you know, you're going to be damned. He's saying, hey, okay, I can engage this. Sandy, I saw your hand up. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering if you can take it to a personal level as well, mm-hmm. when you think about a time in your own personal life when you really hadn't heard about Jesus, didn't know about him. May have been when you were a child, may have been when you may have gone through adult part of your adult life in that, so you would have been in a time of ignorance.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely layers to this, and I think that reading certainly works. It helps. I mean, if you're listening to this as a sermon, right, to hear it on that personal level, I think that works too. Absolutely. What else do we see in this, or things that grabbed your attention in this kind of long passage we just read? Yeah, go ahead, Dixie.
Well, it's just interesting that the author in the last, in verse 34, he specifically mentions a woman.
Yeah. 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 Again, there it is, right? Luke just having to include these little details that they're so overlooked in the church, right? So overlooked in the church. And I'm really grateful for Luke, whoever Luke was writing this text, right? To make sure that those details are not overlooked. Mm. Other pieces of this. What do y'all make? I want to kind of center us in here a little bit. The center of what Paul is saying here. So he's kind of reading the terrain like a tourist. Athens is a big deal, right? Athens is a big deal to us today, but Athens is the center of the world, right? It's one of the, if you were a Greek, I'm sorry, if you were a Roman of upstanding character and you're going to go into politics, and what you do is you hire a Greek teacher from Athens in these days, right? This is the seed of wisdom. This is where all intelligent people are from. They're from Athens. They hang out at the Areopagus. So here Paul is, and he's kind of going through, he's sort of given this sermon like a tourist, like, hey, Athenians, I'm really impressed with you all. And, you know, I saw a temple, and this is what my question is for you all. I saw a temple there, and I found among one of your altars of worship an altar with the inscription, to an unknown God. What do we make of this? This is kind of an interesting little tactic he's taken here. Did anybody else have any note of that? Or, yeah, go ahead, Stephanie.
He's a good salesman. He went in and he saw that, and he proceeds to tell them, we really aren't different from one another. You already espouse these things. It's not a huge revolution like other people are saying. We have like things together.
When you said he's like a salesman, I couldn't help but think of Larry, right? Your late husband, Larry Jordan, right? You can even imagine, I mean, in some ways, I think that's a great comparison here. Larry walking in and saying, "Hey, I noticed you have this altar. And by the way, I got some more information about that for you, which I'm happy to sell you this, or I have a pamphlet." Larry had that same gift, right? He could do that. I remember that.
Yes,
Yeah.
absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I think you're absolutely right. Sometimes there are different methods that Christians have used in missionary activity, some of which are violent and ugly. We don't need to go there. Some of which have been okay, but you take the existing culture that's in an area and you smash it. That's also a version of violence. I don't like that. One of the most fascinating ways that missionary work has been done in the last 500 years or so, or one of the most fascinating examples is actually of the way the Episcopal, the Anglican Church, set about doing evangelism among the Maori people in New Zealand. Instead of supplanting indigenous culture and saying, "You got to toss out everything, it's no good, here's Jesus," they went about this sort of methodology here of saying, "Huh, you have these images in your culture and these ways of speaking and these ways of imagining who God is or the divine or what spirit is. We want to tell you about Jesus. We want to speak your language." And so one of the it's kind of popular among, pastors like me. People will often have a New Zealand Episcopalian book of worship. I don't have one. I'm not that cool. But it's because they've taken the Episcopal Church has taken the Lord's Prayer and interpreted it through the lens of New Zealand's indigenous people. So the English version of the Lord's Prayer spoken in New England is not the same as the Lord's Prayer spoken in England. It's in English, but the practitioners, the worshipers in New Zealand speak a version of the Lord's Prayer that incorporates imagery from Maori culture. Isn't that beautiful? In a way, that's exactly what Paul is doing here. He's saying, it's this real generosity of saying, "You know what? God has been at work in ways that I've been ignorant to. We've all been ignorant to, but God has still been at work. Let's explore this together." Yeah, go ahead, Sandy.
I'm not sure where in the Bible it talks about everyone is responsible for having recognized there is a God, because we look at his creation, we see what he has done, and it had to be someone so special, so majestic, so you can't even put it all, I guess, all the synonym, all the adjectives I'm looking for right now, but we have a responsibility to recognize that there was someone so much greater than us that had to put this all together.
There's, I've given this image before. So if you've heard this before, forgive me. You're gonna hear it again. It'll do you good. No, I have a friend who, we like to talk a lot about interfaith work, right? And what it means to be in conversation with people of other completely different other traditions, right? Other Christians, but also Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists, agnostic, atheist, you name it, right? Zoroastrian. And one of the ways that we can do this is we can do like the competitive thing, right? Here's what I have. It's better than you. Here's my proof text. Here's why I'm right. Here's why you're wrong. Kind of putting one another down. We know the history of that. That gets ugly. Another way of doing it is encouraging one another, imagining that each tradition or each of us are like trees. And the invitation is, okay, you seek or you sink your roots down where you are. I will sink my roots down where I am, right? So my roots are Lutheran, Christian. I'm gonna sink those down as far as I can. I'm gonna investigate what it is to be a Lutheran Christian as deeply as I possibly can. And one of my friends used to say, my guess is when we both dangle those roots down into the aquifers deep down below, we're gonna be drinking from the same well, right? We're going to find one another in the depths down there. Now, the expressions are gonna be quite different. Deep down in the substance of the divine, right? Deep down in those wells of those things that nourish our spirits, we'll find one another there. I love that image of what it is to do work collaboratively with other good faith, people of good faith, people of hope, people of trust, people kind of who have that divine spark. Go ahead, Bruce. Yeah. Oh, Bruce, I had to mute you. I was getting some weird stuff. Can you unmute yourself? Cheryl to the rescue. Oh. I'm sorry, Bruce. There we go. You're on.
Thanks, Cheryl. She's good roots.
She's good. Yeah.
I'm really thankful that you shared that because that's beautiful and it helps explain sometimes when we disagree with other people, we just don't understand sometimes where they're coming from. And maybe if you dig down deep enough, the roots are really similar.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, me too. And it means that the trees are quite different and the fruit of those trees are very different, right? But yeah, we're drinking of the same substance down below.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, Dixie, go ahead.
I liked the reference to we are his offspring. I think that kind of unites all of us. As one group, we're all family. And I just think that was a nice way of putting it.
Yeah, we could, in some ways, Dixie, we could kind of use some of this rhetoric today, right? I mean,
Right.
we in this world where things are so divided, we can't find any common ground sometimes. Yeah, I love we are God's offspring. Others, any other reject rejections, any other reflections on this text? Yeah, go ahead, Sandy.
Don't think these Athenians and foreigners expected what they were going to get from Paul this day, because they would come and gather and they would do nothing else but kind of gossip around with each other. And now something very special is going to happen. This has got to have been a huge surprise and awakening.
Yeah, and they even let's see, there is even kind of a way that I kind of think that verse 21, even kind of get Luke. This is Luke being very prejudiced. Like there's a little bit of an ethnic prod here. Luke says, now all the Athenians and the foreigners living there would spend their time in nothing but telling or hearing something new. That's like they're vapid gossips, right? They just like to sit and do that. Luke is showing, whoever Luke is kind of poking fun at the Athenians, I think. Athenians have a reputation of being very high and mighty, and Luke has taken them down a couple of notches. Has anybody stood here on the Areopagus before? We've talked about the Acropolis. I know Bruce and Cheryl, I think you've mentioned, but has anybody been to Athens?
Yeah, Cheryl,
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Sherry and Stephanie. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I remember standing on the Areopagus thinking, it's just a big rock in the middle of the city where people would stand up and talk and give lectures and meet. And then down below is where the marketplace is and the vendors and the schools of philosophy. So it really, yeah, that place sort of makes me have a little tingle to it because, well, I'm a philosopher, so it's a center of my universe too, in a different place. Go ahead, Stephanie.
Seems to me that this is where the cream of society would gather, because they're the only ones who have time to sit around and talk about ideas or what's new over here, or so I almost get that feeling that it's not really gossip, where they're more brainstorming ideas, because they also recognize that they are the ones who lead the society and where it's.
I mean, and that's why I say I think Luke is being a little Luke is sort of turning the screw here in a way that is a little unfair, right? I in some ways I kind of read it like Luke comes out of a backwater place called Judea, right, or Galilee, but who forever has heard that the center of the world is Rome and Athens. That's where people who matter go. And all of a sudden, Luke's got a story to tell that has emerged out of his home country, his place. And so in a way, I think Luke's kind of like, ha, stick it to you, Athens. We're cool too. It's less childish than that. But yeah. You're right. And I think that's what Paul sees too, Stephanie. That's what Paul's generosity comes from seeing Athens as an important place, right? With important people. Important people want to engage with important ideas. And Paul is saying, hey, people, here's an important idea that you need to engage with this, right? Let me tell you about this, this life-changing, earth-shattering news of Jesus' death and resurrection. You're going to want this one.
Yeah, he
Yeah.
knows that if the good news is going to spread, these are the people he needs.
Yeah. Beautifully said. Beautifully said. Yeah. So Paul's not above selling this to people who are going to sell it to others in a way. Well, I want to share. I'm not going to turn off. We're going to say two prayers today, if that's okay. One, I'm going to say before we go, and you actually can just let this wash over you, and then we'll do our usual thing where we turn off our recording and we'll collect some prayers and say that prayer. But listen to the Lord's Prayer of the Mori in Polynesian. So it turn now. Now think of your version of the Lord's Prayer as you hear this, and then hear this language that Christians in New Zealand have given this. Eternal Spirit, Earth Maker, Pain Bearer, Life Giver, Source of all that is and that shall be, Father and Mother of us all, loving God, in whom is heaven. The hallowing of your name echo throughout the universe. The way of your justice be followed by the peoples of the world. Your heavenly will be done by all created beings. Your commonwealth of peace and freedom sustain our hope and come on earth. With the bread we need today, feed us. In the hurts we absorb from one another, forgive us. In times of temptation and test, strengthen us. From trial too great to endure, spare us. From the grip of all that is evil, free us. For you reign in the glory of the power that is love, now and forever. Amen.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah. I wouldn't be opposed to using that in church sometime.
I agree. I
Yeah.
vote for it.
Agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous. And
It's beautiful.
in a lot of ways, You think of those occasions in history when Christians have done the opposite, right? When we've squashed indigenous expressions of divine, and what we're missing out on in that, right? We lose a preciousness, I think, in that. I'm grateful y'all responded that way. Thanks. We're gonna say goodbye to our friends with us online, and we're gonna collect up some prayers this evening before we go home. So ta-ta to those who are with us online. We'll see you next time.